Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to Season 2 of Novel Dialogue, a literary podcast sponsored by the Society for Novel Studies. I'm Aarti Vade, my co-host is John Plotz. We take turns hosting episodes throughout the season. If you are new to our show, Novel Dialogue brings critics and novelists into lively conversations about how we read, write, publish, and remember novels. And today, we are expanding our usual format to stage a trialogue between the wonderful novelist Cristina Rivera Garza and critics Kate Marshall and Dominique Vargas. Professor Rivera Garza is, of course, much more than a novelist. She is a prolific writer of short stories, poetry, essays, and nonfiction. She is also a translator and founder of the first Spanish language doctoral creative writing program in the United States. She has been awarded more prizes than I can count, but suffice to say, she is a MacArthur genius, and her novels, most recently, the beautifully eerie The Taiga Syndrome, have been translated into multiple world languages. So thank you so much for making time for us, Professor Rivera Garza.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Yes, we're very excited. Professor Kate Marshall joins us from Notre Dame, where she is an associate professor of English and the author of a fantastic book on American literature and media studies entitled Corridors. She's currently finishing up a second book about novels by non-human narrators. And our third guest is Dominique Vargas, who is a postdoctoral fellow at Notre Dame and has just defended her dissertation on decolonial consciousness in multi-ethnic women's literature. So congrats, Dominique. Welcome. Welcome, Kate. Say hi to everyone.
Hello. Hi. Thank you.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Aarti.
Yes. And without further ado, I'm passing the mic to Dominique to get us started.
Hi, thanks. Thank you so much, Professor Rivera Garza, for taking time to talk to us today. I think we'll start with just sort of a basic question and ask you, how did you know you wanted to be a writer? How did you start writing?
Well, that's apparently a simple question, right? It's always very complicated. And I tend to have a couple of answers for that. Now that I look back, I think it all started because I was an avid reader as a child, and reading, all kinds of books, not necessarily novels or not necessarily literature. I read some chronicles, I read some history of medicine, some accounts by botanists. So just getting close to the written word allowed me to dream, to imagine different worlds. And I believe that's pretty much the seed that started it all.
And did you do that from a very young age?
We used to travel a lot too. We used to take a lot of long road trips when I was a child. I'm talking about being 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, pre-teenage, I suppose. And in addition to reading, I think these long road trips allowed me to to just get used to imagine alternative worlds, alternative ways of being in this world. So I think both came more or less at the same time. Not extremely young, but somehow getting there to the age, you know, to the teenage years when you are questioning everything, interrogating everything around you.
Well, thank you for also giving me some good motivation to continue my policy of not using iPads on long road trips with my young children, who I've been encouraging to spend a little bit more time in their heads as we travel the country. It's, you know, it's really interesting to hear about your about this early reading and how you're thinking about different ways of engaging with texts, you know, ranging from stories to botany texts. And we were wondering if we could ask you about other ways in which you could describe the key influences on your work.
I'm so glad you mentioned the issue of technology. I should have mentioned, Kate, that when I'm talking about these road trips, these very long road trips all across northern Mexico, the car was one of those old Volkswagen sedan cars, you know, the bochitos, we call them in Mexico. And of course, it didn't have a radio. So it was a very basic type of car. So there is so much you can talk in family in these very long trips. So there is nothing else left after a couple of hours but the imagination. So engaging with that in a very active and dynamic way transforms what you see through the windows into, you know, entire movies, entire novels, very complicated plots and everything. So that was very relevant. And that allows me to talk a bit about those influences, I think, and the names are the names that you usually hear when Latin American literature is mentioned. Juan Rulfo in Mexico, Rosario Castellanos, a wonderful woman writer too. Poets also, López Velarde, Ramón López Velarde from Mexico as well. Later on, when I was in the university, women writers like, of course, Virginia Woolf and Marguerite Duras and, you know, a range of both women and men authors. But I have to say, I read a lot of women. That was not something that I chose consciously. It just seemed they were available and they seemed to be important in the way I was trying to think about my place in the world as well.
So listening to you talk about sort of the ability to have time, and I'm wondering if that branches into your work as well. What's your relationship like with your books once they're done? Do you go back and revisit them? Do you take some time apart?
When I'm doing readings, that's when I read my books back, and I cannot help it. I'm worshiping my own work, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, this comma shouldn't be there. That word is not the exact word. I should change that. This paragraph needs a better closing sentence. So it's a very dramatic experience. It's never like this is complete and done. So in a way, it is. The exploration is. But the work of writing, that's never ending. And there is always space for something else, for an alternative view, for a new word, for something that I would do differently now. And given the chance, like when I'm translating, when I'm working with translators specifically into English, I take every single opportunity to rewrite my books. So if I could, I would change some of the titles of my books too. But I've been told that that's not a good idea. because of the identity of the book, you know. But also because you cannot offer an old book with a new title to readers. It would be like lying to them, and that I wouldn't do. I wouldn't like to do that. But you know, books change. Books evolve.
When you were talking about having a relationship with your translators and not letting a book end, I'm reminded of, you know, other writers who either auto-translated their work, or, you know, Tagore translated Garibare as The Home and the World. And in Bengali, that would be Inside Outside, which has a very different resonance in his own national tradition versus, say, an American or global tradition. But also Aimé Césaire, who kept coming back to Cahiers and kept rewriting that poem throughout his career. I was just curious if you, with your translators, feel like you're revisiting and rewriting a text that could follow you for longer, you know, a text that you maybe is more like your life, or that changes with your, as your life changes.
Yeah, there is definitely that sensation. It's very organic too. And I have another story for that one as well. I was working with, that was Susan G. Levin and Aviva Khanna in the translation of The Taiga Syndrome. And, you know, I wrote that, I published that book in Mexico. It was classified as a book of literature, just that. But once it was translated into, I guess, literary fiction, that's how you would use, that would be the label in English. But once it was translated into English, I was very surprised, pleasantly surprised, that the book won the 2018 Shirley Jackson Award, which is, you know, it's a very different reading of the book. One that I loved, of course, one that taught me to read my book in a different way, to look at scenes and plot lines and character development in such a different way. So I love the power of translation in that sense. That is not only the moving language, you know, from one type of registered into a different one, you are able to cross genre lines.
So we were gonna make some space for you to give a brief reading, and now might be a great time to invite you to read from your work.
So what I think it'd be a good moment to read the last section of this book. It's the title in English is Keep Writing. I'm not gonna read every single one, it would be too long, but I'll read a couple of the sentences right here. Because we become social in language, my I for your you for me, or you all for them. Because writing by nature invites us to consider the possibility that the world can, in fact, be different. Because the secret mechanism of writing is imagination. Because imagination is another word for criticism, and these the other word for subversion. Because those who write will never adapt. Because memory. Because writing teaches us that nothing is natural. Things are closer than they appear. Writing also tells us that. Because it is through that rectangular artifact we call a book that we communicate with our death, and all of the dead are our death. Because a sentence produces memories that will be inhabited by the names of Marco and José Luis Piña Dávila, Ciudad Juárez, Chihuahua, January 30th, 2010. Because belonging is something I do through you, sentence. Because at the end of each line, there is an abyss worth tumbling into, or launching yourself into, or disappearing into. Because look how the verb to burst out of itself. Because too, it is what we would write in the case that we were to write. Because a line is an imprecation or a prayer. Because terror stops there where the word terror stops inscribed. because a paragraph is an extreme sport. Because language is a form of opposition that always takes us elsewhere. Because it is only through writing that the here is founded, because the now. Because while the violence invites and acquires unprecedented forms, contemporary language has difficulty giving it plausible names. Martin and Brian Almanza, Nuevo Laredo, Reynosa, Matamoros, April 2010. Because in the rectangle of a page, I am nourished and I dream and I plunged and I die. Because there too, I am reborn. We are reborn. Because yes is a small and sacred and savage word all at the same time. Because I do not forget, because we will not forget.
Thank you. And I really love that section of grieving, the section called Keep Writing. And one of the lines that wasn't part of this reading is one in which you say, because this is the most definitive form of the collective. And I wanted to think a little bit about that with you and ask you to talk a little bit more about this picture that you've been really building with us all day about how writing produces collectivities.
Yeah. I've been working for quite a while about a concept, disappropriation. I published the book recently translated into English, by the way, by Robin Myers, called The Restless Death, Negro Writing and Disappropriation. And essentially what I did there was trying to think, trying to give a sense of the kinds of thinking processes that I've been going through as I try to explain myself and others how writing comes into being, especially one that is situated in the United States, a writing that I do in Spanish in the United States while I'm working as a professor at different universities, right? So there has been, I'm very aware of a very important discussion that we've been having as a collective about issues of appropriation, issues of who has the right to say what and to write what. And the way in which I've been thinking about is precisely through the issue of disappropriation. Essentially, I mean, it's way more complicated than whatever I want to say right now, but it's an invitation to consider that the root of all writing processes are, the roots are plural, that we are first members of a community, and then when that community fails, is that we become individuals. That when we stereotypical pictures of writers that depict them, you know, by themselves in front of the computer and with a huge bookcase behind them, as though they are troubled souls, struggling by themselves against the world. That's something that I'm essentially questioning all the time. Because essentially, I'm going to repeat a bit what I've said earlier, but when I'm using language, and that's what I do, when I'm exploring and working with language, which is what I do when I write, there is a sociality in it. There is no way that I can do that by myself. That's the reason I've said there is no solitude in writing. I might appear to be by myself in front of the computer, but if I'm working with language, I'm working with entire histories. I'm working with my community or what I consider to be my community, but I'm working with a range of communities too. That is to me the great capacity, the power of writing, and responsibility too. So, because the language I'm using is not of my own making, because it brings with them all these embedded histories and stories, And because what I do is part of an ongoing larger dialogue that involves many other practitioners. That's basically why I'm saying this, that appears to be a solitary profession, it's not at all, ever, right? And then as a consequence, as a result of that, I think that writing has this enormous capacity for community making. In terms, as I said, of the telling of the stories, but also in terms of the way in which we interrogate language in general, and different communities with different cultural mores, with different needs, with different dissensus processes have ways, specific ways to approach language and what language is for, right? I've said recently on the occasion of the publication of El Invencible Verano de Liliana, my most recent book in Spanish, which is an exploration of the femicide of Liliana Rivera Garza, my youngest sister. I've said that it's taken me 30 years. This tragedy occurred on July 16, 1990. So 31 years after that, I was finally able to write this story. And I did that, I was able to do it because collectively now we have generated a language that allows me to tell this story without resorting to the usual mores of the passionate crimes or the usual way of telling this story from the patriarchal point of view, which usually makes the victim responsible and exonerates the perpetrator. So it is not something that we can decide on our own. We work with these materials and this weight that might appear to be such a long wait, 31 years in the specific case of the book that I'm talking about, is just something that was personal, my own personal process of grieving process, but it's also social. The way in which the time that has taken us, and specifically to feminist mobilizations throughout the world, to produce a language with which now I can tell this story with dignity and faithfully too, and critically as well. And another way, obviously, is something that we do on campuses, on university campuses, right? We teach creative writing. To me, it was extremely relevant to be able to collaborate, to contribute to the emergence of this PhD in creative writing in Spanish, especially because it took place in 2017, a crucial year of recent politics. And it was very important to me that we were doing this as Spanish was being deleted from the pages of the White House. And to be able to say that in that year, we launched a program that might allow writers who write in Spanish in this country was part of my activism, my writing activism. And that to me is important. We can do way more. And many other people do wonderful, very important. They engage with communities in other ways. But this is what I see as my own responsibility. This is what I can do. We are, after all, about 50, 60 million Spanish speakers in this country. Spanish is hardly a foreign language in the United States. I live in the second largest Spanish speaking country in the world. Every time that I say this, it's like, where this woman might be living? It's like the United States.
That's such a fascinating set of ideas. And you've introduced so many interesting concepts into the conversation. I mean, disappropriation being one of them, but also an aesthetic collectivism as an antidote to aesthetic individualism, which is, I think, what often defines experimental writing to a lot of people, right? Yep. The sense that you are pursuing difficulty or incomprehensibility in the name of somehow breaking with the community, not conveying a communal spirit. I was going to go back one step and ask you about that doctoral program, Creative Writing in Spanish, and to think about that in terms of a topic that has come up several times on our podcast, which is decolonizing the university and how one does it. right? Yeah.
Those are two wonderful, wonderful questions, and I think they go together. Let me just very briefly elaborate on the first one. It has to do with issues of experimentation. I've said this also in regards to my most recent book, but I think it applies to earlier works as well, that in order for me to be able to write this book in the way in which it was written, I had to investigate, contest, struggle with received narratives, received powerful hegemonic narratives of violence against women. And so experimentation is not an option, right? It's not a decision that that an individual can take on his or her own. I think in my case, what I would like to think is that in order for me to be able to tell this story, as I said earlier, with dignity and with political relevance, I had to not only pose the questions, but also to subvert the form. So both things to me are related. And of course I'm a writer, and at times I indulge myself. I like some of the exercises that the professional readers might enjoy more than readers that are not professors of literature, let me put it that way, right?
Casual readers.
Yeah, these casual readers, and as relevant what they do as what we do. I didn't want to imply anything else. But as much as I can indulge myself in that exercise, when I'm writing, when I'm engaging into a longer project, that's my task. So I have to investigate language. I have to do something because without that, there's no aesthetic moment. There is no aesthetic operation to begin with, and therefore the whole ethical aspect of it gets missed too. So that's extremely important. So I don't consider that to be a feat of a deed of extreme individualism. I think it's just a matter of obedience, honoring the materials that I'm working with, rather than the opposite. You see, and on the other hand, I think there's much to be done about decolonizing both writing and the university. I think the PhD that I'm working with is housed in the Department of Hispanic Studies. I'm betting on the fact. I truly believe that the future. Let me find a way to put this. In a better way. The PhD program that now we belong to had two tracks, literature and linguistic, which is the usual structure for many of these departments. And we came to add a third one, creative writing. I do believe that this is the future for Department of Hispanic Studies or Departments of Spanish and Portuguese or Departments of Romance Languages. There is of course the pull, the attraction that creative writing elicits among students, and that's in terms of numbers is incredibly relevant. But also there are pedagogical tools that we bring into campus and to the discussion of language that are extremely relevant for future professors of Spanish in this country. So there is the horizontal structure of the workshop, the careful reading and consideration of text, the conversation that is central to workshopping in general, and the possibility to being vulnerable even in a university setting, in a PhD program, which usually requires the opposite, right? We have to think that we know what we are doing and we have what it takes, we have the stamina and the determination. Well, yes, we all have to do that, but at the same time, we can be vulnerable and allow dissent and allow this critical conversation that to me is extremely relevant in the pedagogy of creative writing programs. So there are many, many limitations that comes with the university setting, and I'm very aware of that. But there are issues specifically about public universities that are very dear to me. And I am the product of a public university. Without the UNAM and later the University of Houston, I wouldn't be the professor and writer that I am now. And I'm saying that in terms of in structural terms, you know, in terms of finances and the economy, but also in terms of the friendships and in terms of the conversation, right? And I would like to think that creative writing programs that are placing community and community making processes and practices at the center of their own exploration will teach us something about decolonizing the university.
So I have the final question, which is a tradition of this podcast. So Novel Dialogues always asks, what is your favorite treat while you're in the throes of writing? So what do you do or play or eat when the going gets really tough?
Oh my gosh. Let's see. I usually write in the mornings. That's my best time. That's my best energy, especially after, you know, right after waking up. And I'm not so sure if I'm still dreaming, I'm already thinking. That kind of threshold is important to me. But obviously I have to do something to just start typing. And that would have to be green tea.
I love that.
Yeah, yeah, that's, and then I continue with that. It's much better than coffee. I had to quit coffee, but for, you know, health reasons. But I would say that it's simple, it's powerful, and it helps me.
I have to say that's my favorite answer because I drink about 6 cups of green tea a day.
I switched to it from coffee recently too. It's good.
Is that right? Yeah. It's much better, right? It's less, I don't know. I get less jittery.
It's a nice slow burn throughout the whole day.
Yeah. I agree. So it's been a good change in my life. Yeah. Writing life.
Well, I'm going to thank you all for letting me make it a quadrilogue every now and then, but I thought this was a really wonderful trialogue, and I will just send us out. John and I are grateful to the Society of Novel Studies for its sponsorship and acknowledged support from Duke University and Brandeis. Nai Kim is our production designer, Claire Ogden is our audio engineer. Hannah Jorgensen is our transcript editor, and James Draney is our blog editor. Past and upcoming episodes include Mark Walliger talking to Tom Parada, Corinna Stan with Carol Phillips, and Colleen Lai in conversation with Viet Tan Nguyen. From all of us here at Novel Dialogue, thanks for listening. And if you liked what you heard, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.